Thank you, Bill. My name is Lee Edwards. I'm a fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and I'm pleased to be with you this morning to chair this last panel. And of course, as so often is the case, we save the best for last. But before we allow these bright, shining young faces to tell us what the future of conservatism is going to be, we've talked quite a bit at this meeting about fusionism. And the organizers, Mr. Campbell and President Nash, have allowed me to spend just a few minutes talking about fusionism, giving a little background, because I do think that at least one of our panelists is going to be talking about fusionism. Brian, let me put it to you this way. Conservatives, as we have been able to tell from this meeting, are a disputatious lot. And their disputes are passionate and often personal, precisely because they revolve around the most important thing in politics, ideas. Therefore, far from being signs of a crack up or a breakdown, intense, uninhibited debate among conservatives is an unmistakable sign of intellectual vigor in a national movement whose influence and longevity continue to surprise many in the political and the academic worlds. Now, the dispute between traditionalists and libertarians has been among the fiercest and most protracted in American conservatism. Like the generational conflicts of the Hatfields and the McCoys, the philosophical feuding between these two branches of conservatism has been going on for some 50 years. Recall back when Ayn Rand's novel, Atlas Shrugged, became a bestseller in the late 1950s and began attracting young conservatives. Whitaker Chambers responded with perhaps the most famous and scathing book review in the history of National Review. As our colleague George Nash points out in his indispensable study, The Conservative Intellectual Movement in America, the Chambers called the novel's plot preposterous, its characterization primitive, its overall effect sophomoric, and he was just getting started. Arrogant, dogmatic, intolerant of any opposition to its message, Chambers argued. A voice could be heard in almost every page of the novel, to a gas chamber, go. Well, Rand did not immediately retaliate, but later declared that National Review was, quote, the worst and most dangerous magazine in America. Its mixture of capitalism and religion, she said imperiously, sullied the rational with the mystical. But there were other battles, and one of the fiercest was waged in the early days between Frank Meyer, a young communist in his early days turned radical libertarian, and Russell Kirk, a deeply rooted traditionalist. Meyer was not impressed with Kirk's seminal work, The Conservative Mind, saying that Kirk and like-minded conservatives had no grounding in any, quote, clear and distinct principle. Indeed, Meyer charged, Kirk did not comprehend the ideas and institutions of a free society. Well, those of us who remember Russell knew that he was not going to take that, you know, sitting or standing or any other way, retorted that individualism, which was the term then used for libertarianism, was social atomism and even anti-Christian. The political result of individualism, he said, was inevitably anarchy. Custom, tradition, the wisdom of our ancestors, Kirk declared, constituted the firm foundation upon which a society should be built. So we had this vast gulf which lay between Meyer's appeal to universal truths, like the freedom of the individual, and Kirk's critique of such abstractions, based upon his own understanding and the importance of history and concrete circumstances. So we had this battle going on. And yet, one conservative became convinced that beneath the conflicting positions and heated rhetoric lay a consensus of opinion and principle. Frank Meyer, who had accentuated the gulf between the traditionalists and the individualists, now dedicated himself to reconciling those differences. As a staunch individualist, Meyer had argued that freedom of the person was the primary end of political action. The state had only three strictly limited functions: national defense, the preservation of domestic order, and the administration of justice between individuals. The achievement of virtue, Meyer insisted, was not the state's business. Individuals should be left alone to work out their own salvation. But Meyer, who had been an extremely effective organizer for the Communist Party in his youth, was a political realist as well as a political philosopher, who understood that the conservative movement needed both traditionalists and individualists, or libertarians, to be politically successful. And so he set about his task. In his 1962 book, In Defense of Freedom, Meyer writes that the Christian understanding of the nature and destiny of man is what conservatives are trying to preserve. Both traditionalists and individualists should therefore acknowledge the true heritage of the West, reason operating within tradition. This theory was later dubbed fusionism by Brent Bozell, actually, which Meyer said was based on the conservative consensus already forged by the founders at the 1787 Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. And to demonstrate that the fusionist synthesis was not a fantasy, Meyer assembled a diverse group of conservative intellectuals and in 1964 published their answers to the basic question, what is conservatism? Despite real differences, Meyer writes, the contributors ranging from Hayek to Kirk to Buckley agree on several fundamentals. They accept an objective moral order of immutable standards by which human conduct should be judged. Whether they emphasize human rights and freedoms or duties and responsibilities, they unanimously value the human person as the center of political and social thought. They oppose liberal attempts to use the state to enforce ideological patterns on human beings. They reject the centralized power and direction necessary to the planning of society. They join in defense of the Constitution as originally conceived. And finally, they are devoted to Western civilization and acknowledge the need to defend it against the messianic intentions of communism. And so, by the mid-60s, the tumult between the disputants had nearly subsided, and fusionism had become a fait accompli. Nash says that most conservatives adopted fusionism because they wanted to. That is, they wanted to believe they had found a common basis of understanding. They were tired of feuding, of endlessly debating how many traditionalists and libertarians can dance on the head of a pin. Fusionism was immensely assisted, Nash points out properly, by the cement of anti-communism, by the reality of a common deadly enemy, the Soviet Union. Fusionism was not a rhetorical trick, but a recognition that conservatism was a house of many mansions, in the words of the traditionalist Raymond English. Fusionism, ecumenism, if you will, was a logical as well as a prudent resolution of a seemingly intractable problem. So here we are today. Well, in the wake of the 2006 elections, the escalating debate between neoconservatives, paleoconservatives, libertarians, and just plain conservatives about the future of conservatism, with some arguing that it has none, a new fusionism has been proposed as a solution. It is time, some say, for Republicans and conservatives to return to their small government roots and get away from so-called religious extremism. And they point to Barry Goldwater as the historical model, claiming that he had little interest in the moral side of the political equation. I have to say, and I had a little something to do with that campaign back in 1964, this is a serious misreading of Goldwater's fundamental views as a best-selling author and presidential candidate. Goldwater consistently offered a blend of traditionalist and libertarian ideas. In the Conscience of a Conservative, that wonderful little political manifesto published back in 1960, Goldwater stressed that there was a spiritual as well as an economic side of man. In 1964, when he was running for president, this is a very typical quote, he said, "It is impossible to maintain freedom and order and justice without religious and moral sanction." So, Frank Meyer, the intellectual father of fusionism, and Barry Goldwater, the first political apostle of fusionism, sought to unite, not divide, all conservatives. Their goal was a national movement guided by constitutional principles of ordered liberty. And it seems to me that the solution for the American conservative movement in these challenging times is not a new, but a renewed fusionism. But certainly we would have to agree that fusionism requires more than a consensus as to goals. It needs some cement. It needs a foe common to all conservatives. As we know, militant communism served as a unifying threat from the late 1940s through the late 1980s. In the early 1990s, however, without the soothing presence of Ronald Reagan and with the collapse of communism, large fissures appeared in American conservatism. Well, these fissures produced paleoconservatives pining for the isolationist 1930s and neoconservatives resurrecting Wilsonian dreams of a world made safe through democracy. And Leviathan's lengthening shadow across America did not suffice to bring conservatives together until Newt Gingrich and his merry band of congressional revolutionaries offered America a contract that was fusionist in spirit and helped them win a majority in the House of Representatives. The terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, and the jihad proclaimed by Islamic fundamentalists temporarily united the nation and the conservative movement, but political partisanship quickly reemerged to make prudential governance and reasoned discourse difficult, if not impossible. The impasse, I believe, can be broken with a renewed fusionism based on limited government, the free market, individual freedom and responsibility, a prudent balance between liberty and order, and a commitment to virtue, both private and public. These are the core beliefs bounded by the Constitution on which American conservatism rests and by which its leaders have always sought to govern. Thank you. And now to the fun part. Ladies and gentlemen, you see before you the future of conservatism. Smile. These four young men and women are among the very best and brightest of our movement, and what a deliciously diverse group. Amanda Carpenter, congressional correspondent and assistant editor of Human Events, whose expose about Hillary Clinton and the vast right-wing conspiracy left the New York senator sputtering. Christopher Coyne, assistant professor of economics at Hampton Sydney College, who raises high the standard of Austrian economics. Gerald Rosello, practicing lawyer, author, editor of Yale University Bookman, whose insightful book about Russell Kirk and his postmodern imagination, and when I first saw that, postmodern imagination, Russell Kirk, a postmodern, oh wow. So, I'm still trying to work that out. But anyway, it is a required reading for traditional conservatives. And finally, Ryan Sager, the online editor of the New York Sun, unapologetic libertarian. And his latest work has this marvelous title, The Elephant in the Room, Evangelicals, Libertarians, and the Battle to Control the Republican Party. And this book has captivated Republicans and readers searching for their future. So I'm going to call for our kickoff from the down in Hampton City. I'm going to ask Mr. Coyne, then Mr. Sager, then Ms. Carpenter, Mr. Rosello to tell us, what lies ahead.